folks, how's it going? It is Dave the Drummer here, back with the very first episode of what is looking to be the last season of the Talking Drum. And we have some fantastic interviews with friends new, friends old. This time around, we decided to go and talk to drummers all around the world. And we wanted to really go all out for this final season of the show. Having said that, we were able to make contact with Billy over at Glass Onion via Pat Mastellotto of King Crimson and the Stickmen, who helped us get hooked up. And Billy was a huge, huge part of getting folks to come and talk to us for this final season. And I want to send a special shout out to Billy. And also want to say it was real awesome to see Pat play the talking drum, the namesake of the show, over in San Jose with the Stickmen a couple months back. And yeah, it was a fantastic time. Great show, guys. We want to take a minute to say thanks to our sponsors for the season. We've got some brand new sponsors and we've got some returning. First off, we want to give a big shout out to JVQAV. They are the premier audio visual equipment rental and services people that you want to go and hit up for parties, weddings, events, corporate retreats. They are the company that you want to get with. Make sure to head over to jbqav.com. You need to put in my name and say, Dave the Drummer sent me, and I'm sure our good friend Jaron, who helped create the show, will be more than generous with an estimate for whatever you need. We want to say thanks to Santa Cruz Drum Club, okay? They are a very, very awesome group of folks that get together and help bring drum clinics over to cool places like the Kumbwa Jazz Center. We want to say thanks to Rick Tahira and all the hard work that he puts into with the various other members of the drum club, which we've had on the show, such as Zach Olson. Finally, we want to say hello to a brand new sponsors. It is the Blue Lounge and Blue Lagoon. Now, the Blue Lounge, I frequently hit them up for karaoke. That's my spot for karaoke. Always have a good time hanging out with Todd and Kelsey, as well as Nina. Occasionally, awesome, talented Brian. It's always a good spot. Always enjoy being there. But head over to the Blue Lounge. Have yourself a drink. Have yourself some fun. It is a good time there. They are in the Seatbright neighborhood here in Santa Cruz. The sister establishment in downtown Santa Cruz, it is called the Blue Lagoon. It is one of the, I would say right now, it's kind of got a lot of momentum going for it. Musical acts and performers just come through and really sort of, I'd say Blue Lagoon has really kind of stepped it up over the last couple of months and has really made a huge effort to really bring some awesome acts over to both of the stages. And it is one of the first places I've actually played a live show. I'm a good friend with the owner, is a awesome guy named Fred, and we want to say a special shout out to Fred. Mr. Fred, thank you for being an awesome friend and helping us. Why don't we head over to our interview? I want to talk about this episode. Very, very special for me because this gentleman, I have been a huge fan of his for many years, and I would even say he was an inspiration for me to return to playing drums after being away so long. I have a very profound love for the band that he worked with, Doves, and it was his drums in the music that really pulled me, gravitated me towards the band, and there's been some really fantastic drum tracks of his, such as There Goes the Fear, which features some really, really cool Brazilian carnival-inspired drums and beats. You've got Kingdom of Rust, which has some fantastic brushwork that really reminds me of something that would fit in modern country rock. And a personal favorite of mine, which is this fantastic song called Meet Me at the Pier, where Andy is driving the song, but it's a very laid-back beat, very easy listening to, very simplistic song, but it's fantastic. And we were so fortunate to make contact with Andy and have him come on the show. Andy Williams is somebody that made me see drummer's position, the drummer's role in the band, isn't to be the guy in the back. It's to really add a specific touch to that band's sound. And I will always be grateful for Andy. And this is a huge deal for me to have him on the show. Andy Williams, thank you for joining us. I want to get started by talking about how did you get into drums? I would love to hear about the beginning of that story.
Lucky enough to start playing drums when I was probably about, both my brothers decided to play guitar. So I was like, you know, if they're going to play guitar, I'm going to play drums, you know, just to be, sibling kind of rivalry. So I was lucky enough really to start, you know, I was about sort of 11, 10, 11. And I did the classic thing just on, you know, biscuit tins for a couple of years. Yeah, because I really had to save up to get my first kit. So I had to, you know, prove to my mum that I was, you know, reasonably serious about it. But I grew up in a house when there was always music around. My mum was always playing stuff. And I had an elder brother who was very much, you know, getting into rock music. So he used to pick up on his records.
Let's talk about inspiration. Let's talk about what or who has inspired you to be the drummer, be the musician that you are now?
Personally, I'm not one really for listening. I know, you know, I'm not one for just listening to the drums. I kind of, when I listen to music, it's almost like a secondary thing. I guess that's like maybe a lot of musicians, you're listening to the overall. Drummer-wise, I guess, you know, people like Stuart Copeland, I was a massive Police fan. I loved him. Keith Moon from The Who was another early band I really got into. Jimi Hendrix, for some reason I just connected with him when I was 12. So I used to love Mitch Mitchell. And then I guess later when I started getting more into, I suppose, you know, funk and stuff, you know, Elvin Jones and people like that would become more of an influence. But again, you know, I suppose earlier on I used to, you know, study these people, but as you got more into kind of the process of trying to write songs and stuff, it became less important for me to, you know, and it was about the overall song and not playing too much, you know. I mean, I went through the process, I guess, as a lot of musicians doing of, I guess, kind of showing off how many fills can you rock in 2 minutes. I was as guilty as that as anyone. And I guess, as you know, you grow up and playing in lots of bands and you just learn that maybe kind of economy is a better way to go.
Big Boy is talking about he's going to school. Yeah. He's riding his bike and he's listening to Running Up That Hill, and it's super iconic for him, right? So it's influences, right? Our influences come in all different places.
All right. Yeah, I know that cast.
My dad, he listened to a lot of funk, loved Earth, Wind, and Fire. I'm Mexican-American, and so it's not a very usual thing. Showed me early on what it is to have some variety in your taste of music, just because it is really good to be able to be open to all the sounds of the world and not necessarily just like, oh, I'm a country guy or I'm a rock guy. It's like, you got to kind of go all over the place if you really want to really get the most out of the gift that is, you know, that is music, really.
So he was playing all sorts in the house and, yeah, you soaking it in and musical education, I suppose, yeah.
Going through your parents' 45s and going through all the LPs that they have. I just have so many countless memories of just spending time with my dad, just him just playing LPs and making food, and you know, it's it's great. You play with Doves, and you are also playing with Black Rivers with your brother, right? Yeah. What has been your personal experience for playing in a band with your brother? Like, what kind of experience have you had? Do you have any pointers to keep the family relationship good? Because we've seen things like Oasis, where you know, those brothers, they just it gets nuclear, and you know, you guys seem like you're like the opposite of that, you know. So I mean, what does it take, you know, to keep your brother and you on good terms, to, you know, and you keep going because you've been playing with him for, you know, quite a while.
But about 12, you know, we have our little moments like all brothers do. But on the whole, been blessed with a great relationship, really. And you, I think just giving each other space, giving each other respect. We've never had that competitive thing that maybe that a lot of siblings have. We've never had that one-upmanship that I hear, you know, friends and have with the brothers or sisters. So we've never really had that. And we've always tried to sort of, I guess, work to the common cause, really. We've always, you know, we've always had a chemistry between us, you know, and because we've grown up, maybe with a lot of listening to the same music, we have kind of maybe, I guess, a shorthand, really, that we don't have to, a lot can get unsaid and we can just crack on with stuff. But in terms of, just getting on with each other, just give each other room, give each space, give each other respect. You know, I don't think either's got raging egos. I hope not, anyway. We try to keep pretty, you know, our feet on the ground and not get carried away with too much stuff, you know. Jimmy's pretty much a brother as well. We've worked so long together. There's a certain chemistry between us three when, you know, which when me and Jez were working as Black Rivers, wasn't there. You know, it was something. It was something else, which was great. But us three together is a different thing, you know. And I think that's why we both missed that element. I think, well, Jimmy being the element, I suppose. And our hiatus, really, it was you know, it was brilliant to reconnect. I mean, both me and Jez loved the Black Rivers project. We had a great time doing it because we'd had bit of downtime beforehand and we were itching. We were both doing different projects with different people. We kind of gravitated again together to working again. We went out on tour with Martin Rubelski, who plays keys, and a friend, Ollie. And we got out to the States, actually. And we did. And we had a brilliant time, and it was almost back to basics, really. We were back sort of loading the van and, stopping for food at service stations. And it was back to basics again. But, you know, that was cool. It was really good. We really enjoyed it. So, yeah, I think, yeah, in terms of, in some bands, that kind of rivalry between the brothers, you know, can be a very, you know, a great creative thing. And like a band like the Kinks, I suppose, like Dave and Ray Davis, where they've always had that kind of conflict. And it's, you know, you can see certain gigs on stage where definite friction going on, it adds an extra element, you know. So I think throughout the history of bands, there has been, you know, generally as you're growing up, you know, you look to forming a band and you look around, you start with your own family maybe, or maybe you don't, I don't know. But you know, I feel blessed that we've not had that kind of relationship where there's that constant friction. But I can also see it's been a creative thing in certain bands as well, you know?
Beach Boys, it's like a brother, yeah. Brothers and cousins, right? Brothers and cousins, right?
Yeah.
Some folks do it and other folks do it. And obviously it's very individual. But at the same time, you want to ask the people who have been making it work. How do you make it work? Just because there's a lot of folks out there that probably wish they could do the same thing, but you know, like they have that competitiveness, or they have just that mentality where one of them has to be the miser and one of them has to be the oppressed. Yeah. When you find people that they know how to make it work, it's good to pick their brain a little bit to get back on the road. And so I think the information you just gave listeners is fantastic. I do want to say real quick, since you brought up that Jimmy is like a brother, put in perspective with the listeners, the three of you, you were also doing electronic music as Sub-Sub. That was along with Jimmy for a good while. And then, you know, Ain't No Use, and that's a brilliant song. And you guys had a couple of great, you know, tunes that I got to hear as I was getting into you guys. But then the fire happened, and then you all, you know, basically became Doves over the next course of a couple of years. The stories that MTV2 were painting about you guys were literally that you guys were like born of fire. So, I mean, watching that kind of stuff really kind of created a mythos about you guys. To me, as a fan starting out,
like, wow, you know, what a story. You know, they went from sub to Doves. That's a hell of a story. But I did want to give to the listeners that you guys have been working with Jimmy, he's a bass player in Doves. You guys did the dance music. You guys were around the Hacienda Mythic now, right? A lot of people talk about it. You know, there's been movies about it, you know, the last days of, you know, that kind of scene. You know, I think they have a special bond. You and your brother, you've got a special bond. And then you and Jimmy, obviously, because you know, you just mentioned about how, you know, Black Rivers was awesome. But with the three of you, it's just like, damn. Can you tell us about your current drum setup? What's your preferred stick size? I know that you just recorded an album this past year, The Universal Want. And we wanted to just know if there was anything different that you did differently in terms of recording or engineering wise, or maybe there was some cool drum tricks or different drums that you used during the session.
I mean, first I'd say I'm not a massive gearhead. I have to make that I have to fess up. In terms of, so my setup, I have like a kit that I use for the studio and a kit I use for live. So my studio kit is, I've got it right behind me here. It's an old Ludwig. It depends on the song, but yeah, I like to use this mostly. It's like an early 70s Ludwig, kind of gold sparkle. So it's got a 22 inch kick drum, a 13 inch rack tom, and then a 16 inch floor tom. And then I'm pretty lucky. I've got a few snares, which I tend to switch them up in the studio. So my go-to was like a Ludwig snare, like a mid, I don't know the exact name of it, but I think it's like a mid 1960s era snare drum. And I use that a lot on Lost Souls and Last Broadcast. It's a really snappy, it's like 14 inch times, I think 5 inch. Okay. So, that was always my go-to snare. And then if I want something a bit more snare-wise, I've got this Pearl snare, which is a 14 times. It's quite deep. I think it's like a 7 inch or something. And I got really lucky with that snare. It was like it's off my live kit. I mean, Pearl have been really good to me. I've got two Pearl kits, which I use for live. Similar sizes to my studio kit. But then I have like an additional second tom, which is I think it's an 18 inch floor tom. So two floor tom. Yeah, it's that kind of, jazz setup, I guess. I guess it comes from, I got taught for a year or so when I was about 13 off this old jazz guy. And he had a jazz setup and I always loved his kit. So when I started, I always liked the cymbal, the ride cymbal over the kick drum sort of setup. And the low cymbals. But I sort of picked up that off Jack Hume, which was the guy who taught me, actually. Going back to Universal One, the only new piece of gear really I bought was this. I went in a studio whilst we were recording called Eve Studios, which is near Manchester, and they had this lovely little Premier, like a little gold sparkle. I'm looking at it now. Gold sparkle, I guess it's like an early 1960s snare drum. And it was lovely. I played it instantly. I think the track I Will Not Hide on Universal One, which is on the track, I played it on that and I went, right, I'm having one of these. So I just got on eBay that night and found one in exactly the same spec in the same gold sparkle, which matches my Ludwig studio kit. And that's lovely, really snappy snare drum, loads of character, just that kind of vintage sound I do really like. I'm really lucky, top lady from Zildjian Cymbals called Tina, has always really looked after me and sent me Zildjian Cymbals. She's been really, really good to me over the years. So I play like K-series Zildjians. Yeah, with the exception of a Vedas ride cymbal. So I've like a ping ride.
Okay. I found this on the web for Case Series, the exception of a Venus symbol. Check it out.
That Siri kicking in. Did you hear that? I never asked it. It just kicked in of its own. Totally. George Orwell was right, wasn't he? This sentiment is always listening. It's a bit worrying, really, isn't it? Oh, wow. Right. He definitely got it. He predicted it. It's slightly worrying, isn't it? But So yeah, so I'll have like 14-inch K Hyatt hats, and then I'll go for a like a 17 or 19 crash on my kind of left hand side, and then I'll have for live anyway. This is I'll have two ride cymbals. I'll have like a nice clean ride, which is me a Venus ping ride, which is like a 20-inch, and then I'll go for a K. Ride, got a few different K rides, a bit bigger, 22-inch, and then I'll have another crash on my right hand side, another sort of, I don't know, like 19 or a 20-inch crash on the right, and that's it really.
We just discussed that you were working on the Universal Want, the new album, right? I know you guys are super proud of it. I'm super excited for it, but in particular, are there any drum track that made you smile? Or like I said, maybe the engineer was like, man, you should have seen yourself. Like you had like the biggest smile right after, you know, you got done just laying this out. Or maybe while you were doing it, you know, you had like a big smile on your face. Is there any tracks that really stand out to you or have like a special place to you?
Yeah, I guess so. In the place I mentioned before, Eve Studios in Manchester, there's two songs on the album which I really enjoyed playing. I loved, you know, it was kind of, it felt right up my street while I was playing, so to speak, because you know, on every album there's more challenging tracks, and which are great, it's great to challenge yourself in it, but these two I just felt really comfortable, and I really you know, I really enjoyed playing. Yeah, there's a track called For Tomorrow which is on the album. And then another song called Mother Silver Lake, which has got a kind of like, it might not like sound it like to other people, but to us, we will try to go for a kind of Afrobeat groove. I don't know if it worked out that way. We always have this thing in our mind, oh yeah, this is kind of vibe we want to go for. And then, you know, so I don't know whether people can spot that in there, but yeah, those two tracks I really enjoyed playing. I was having a lot of fun playing them. You know, because there's a few songs in this album we were a bit more live than, you know, a lot of Doves albums, where there's a few of the tracks on the album which we actually sort of compile by like patchwork, so we're kind of like using a take from here, a take from there, and we're mixing it up, and then, you know, doing post-production on them, which is something we've always done. But on this album there's a good few songs where we were really just, you know, free, and actually Martin Rabowski, the keyboard, would come in on live, and we'd just try and do it as live as possible. We might have to overdub a vocal, or Jez would want to put a second guitar part on, but the basics, certainly bass and drums, we try to do as live as possible. Yeah, I really like working that way. I love, you know, the fun of it. I love the instant. I think you just get something that you can't really put your finger on, like kind of sort of an X factor that, you know, I guess records have been made like that for like 60 years, haven't they? You know, where people play live. So there's definitely something in that approach that works, doesn't it?
It is my pleasure to introduce my favorite Dove song. Takes me back to high school, and my last year of high school, picking up this album and finding this track. Having listened to Catch the Sun, which was the big popular hit of theirs in 2000, and playing it a whole bunch, and then forgetting to hit the rewind button on my CD player, and listening through to The Man Who Told Everything, the next track on the album, and the first time I heard it, I fell in love with it, and then I got acquainted with the Summer mix, which sounds quite a bit different. Drums are a large part of why I like the Summer mix better. You can hear those drums really come through, and the cymbals and everything, and think is perfect. I wouldn't change a thing about it. This is Andy Williams with Doves. This is The Man Who Told Everything, the Summer mix. Enjoy. Thank you.
What do you like to do to, like, unplug from everything that stresses you out? I know you're a parent. We were just talking about that. And you're also a killer musician, and you're a professional recording artist. So what are some of the things that Mr. Andy Williams does to kind of get away from it all? To kind of, you know, just like, you know, hobby, you know, are you a green thumb? Or, you know, like, what do, you know, to get away from it all?
I like seeing friends. Obviously my family, spend time with family. I love seeing friends. I'm looking out enough to have good friends who will hang out. Then I'll go for a curry, go for a drink maybe. I try trying to do a bit more exercise. So I do a bit of running. I know that can sound a bit boring really, but especially with playing drums, as you're getting older, you need to maintain your fitness, don't you? You know, avoid. you know, I don't want to be in a gig setup where I've run out of steam after four songs. So I try and keep reasonably fit. But I like that. It's quite good mentally for me in a way. So I'll get music on and I'll go running. What else I do? I love listening to music. Reading. I like reading. One thing I really enjoy doing is writing lyrics and reading. Reading kind of does, you know, I get ideas from it. I get, you know, well, I mean, I do it for purely enjoyment, but, you know, occasionally I'll get ideas and, you know, I write them down. And it's something I find, well, firstly, I enjoy, but secondly, I find creatively is, I enjoy doing. So, yeah, certainly in the evening, I'll try and turn off the telly and, and try and read instead.
Doves have a track on Lost Broadcast, right? Great album. The M62 song. So the song is credited to the original lineup of King Crimson. Now, the 1972 model gave us Lark's Tongue and Aspect, which is where we get our name from. One of the tracks off that is the talking drum. So what could you tell us about the influence that they maybe had on you guys? I mean, would you like to talk to us about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I've got Professor, I'm not a massive King Crimson fan. Jimmy is. Jimmy loved loves King Crimson. But weirdly, that song, it's a weird, I heard, I watched a film called Buffalo 66, and I heard that song. I think it was the actor Vincent Gallo did a kind of like a sort of a dance routine to, and so yeah, I mean, we borrowed the melody. I'm not going to lie to you. We were like, wow, but wrote a different melody, vocal melody. And I was like, this is great. This is really, just as soon as I heard it, oh wow, I just heard, you know. So yeah, we obviously cleared it. We went to them and said, you know, we've done this differently, you know, and they, you know, graciously said yes. And yeah, so yeah, I need to check out more King Crimson, really. So now I know they're a really well-respected band. I know Bill Bruford's a really respected drummer, isn't he?
We were talking about snares, right? We were talking about the sound of a snare, right? You're a big fan of a very characteristic snare, and for me, it's all about the sound that his snare produces. Okay. Because he's gone on record countless times and has been like, I've used tons of different snares. And he's like, so when people come and talk to me and they're like, oh, you know, it's always the same across all the way through. It's because he's tuning everything the same way, right? But the thing is he's got a particular tuning. And the way he explained it, if I'm not mistaken, was that when he was playing with Yes early on, they're so loud that he was having to punch through sonically. And so he was having to find that right sweet spot where he would be able to hit the snare. So it's going right through Chris Squire Steve Howe and Rick Wakeman and before them. But anyways, the point is that Bill's having to cut through this sound. And so he develops this technique and he has a very characteristic snare. And so when you hear him throughout like all his tracks, I mean, that snare to me is like the signature. It's like the calling card of Bill Bruford. You know, when you hear that sound, it's just like, I know who's on this track. Yeah. There's an album that Squire did, 76. It's called Fish Out of Water. And Bruford plays on a majority of the tracks on that. And that snare is just still there. It's very restrained because he's not kind of throwing it all out there like he would for, say, UK or for King Crimson or even for his own Bruford stuff later on in the 70s. But that snare sound.
I mean, what an amazing thing to have a signature that you can spot his sound, you know, off a mile away. I mean, that's the ultimate, really, isn't it? In people's playing and... If you can go, well, that's, that's John Bonham. That's Keith Moon. You know, that's the ultimate, isn't it, really, to be able to, somebody to have their own sound.
You go back to Stuart Copeland. You mentioned you're a big fan of Stuart Copeland. So, true story. So, Stuart was probably my first favorite drummer because as a kid growing up, I love the Police. I actually was born... the last year that they are touring, and then about like 6 months later they call it, and that's pretty much it, touring or just being together, Stuart, very influential on myself, and I just loved how low some of those toms that he had, and then he uses roto toms. And so it sounded so cool to me. I always thought it sounded so cool. And then later, I get into Bruford's UK stuff and his Bruford stuff, and he's using the rototoms there too. And so Stuart Copeland, definitely a big one on me too. But he's got a very signature sound as well. But his big thing is I think he's just really fast with his toms and for his hi-hat work, because that's why I think Peter Gabriel got him for the song's called Red Dust or something like that. It's on the second 80s Peter Gabriel album, but he got Stuart Copeland to work on that. It's Red Rain. That's what it is. Red Rain. And he's so fast, right? Stuart's another one who he goes and he tries to go for these different feels. I mean, people had said for a long time that Police were like white man's reggae, right? And they were initially like kind of a punk band.
Yeah.
And so they're like punk reggae, right? I mean, that's very unique. And then he's got all these different styles that they go down, you know, like Mrs. Gridenko and Driven to Tears and Spirits in the Material World. He does all these different sounds and these feels and whatnot. So I mean, when I like to think when I hear Stuart playing too, I can hear Stuart's work. Stanley Clark. He has an album where Stuart Copeland plays on a track and it sounds so good and you're like, oh my god, I'm pretty sure it's Stuart Copeland, and you go and look at the album and it's him. Right. So I mean,
yeah, I've never seen him on the we used to have a program called the Old Grey Whistle Test. You know, everyone in the 70s and 80s, all the great bands played it. It's one of those that introduced so many stuff. So I remember seeing Stanley Clark on that. I was like, wow. Stuart Copeland's incredible. Just a force of energy, wasn't he? He's just, because the Police were a great pop band as well, but, you know, pop with dignity, really. And just, you know, great songwriting, especially those first two albums. And yeah, something at that age when I was about sort of 10, 11, I just started listening to, wow, I love, you know, firstly, I love these songs, but I love the drums, what's going on. Then you learn, you know, who is playing the drums, and then you have a go at trying to emulate, which is nigh impossible to emulate somebody like him. But yeah, he's a unique player, isn't he? And like you said before, you can spot him off a mile away, can't you, when you hear him play? I suppose, you know, we spoke earlier at the moment, which I'm sure it's the same in the US. Venues obviously are not open at the moment, and it's kind of the whole, you know, industry around that, including, you know, all the onstage people who help gigs happen, you know, like the monitor guy, the out front sound, or your onstage techs, the lighting. All these people at the moment are really suffering. They can't earn a living. So there's kind of a movement in the UK at the moment called hashtag We Make Events, where they're just trying to, I suppose, raise awareness, really, of and get some government help for all these self-employed people who kind of make, you know, not just music gigs, but also kind of events happen. And a lot of this talent is going to be kind of lost if they can't obviously earn a living. They're going to have to get jobs elsewhere. So I guess it's going to be the same situation in the States. You know, if we lose that, we're losing a big part of culture, really. If, you know, gigs and festivals can't happen, we're all going to be poorer for it, really. So I guess that's my plug. Yeah. Go and check them out online. Hashtag We Make Events.
Folks can go and check out Dove's back catalog through Spotify, right? I know that that you guys just created the ability to have a playlist. You can create a playlist, your own playlist of Dove songs over the last 20 years that you guys have recorded through Spotify. What about the Black River stuff? Is that as easily accessible? Can folks go to their YouTube or iTunes or Apple Music, whatever it's called now? But Black River stuff, can you find that on Spotify too?
Yeah, it's all available there.
The sub music that you folks had worked on, is that available on streaming services yet?
Most of it is, I think. Sub, if you listen to the later stuff that we did a collaboration with Tricky. Don't know if you're aware of the artist Tricky. And Bernard Sumner. And if you listen to the later stuff, we did collaborations with those two. And we were starting to, you know, use more acoustic instruments. You can definitely hear. It wasn't an overnight thing with Dove start, you know, putting down, you know, our samplers and keyboards and picking up, you know, instruments. We were starting to go that way towards the end of Sub on the way. So I guess if people want to trace the lineage from Sub to Doves, you know, because obviously a song like Space Face or Ain't No Love, which are Sub songs, you hear those and you go to Lost Souls, it seems like it's a massive leap. Actually, it's not the full story, really. Yeah, later in Sub-Sub, we were going back to, before the fire, we were going back to playing instruments. So, yeah, I guess that should be available on streaming services and certainly YouTube if people are interested in just having a look how we ended up as Doves, I guess.
If you're like me and you're kind of curious to see what you guys were up to, I was a big fan of This Time I'm Not Wrong. And the tricky stuff I'm a little less acclimated to, but, I mean, I loved that song. And I could totally see the beginnings of what would become Doves in that song. And so for me, I was like, oh man, like I wonder what else they've got, right? So if there's any folks out there that are new to Doves or just new to the Williams brothers and Mr. Jimmy, they'd be able to go back and say, oh well, I can go to YouTube and I can go check out, you know, Blue Water and Ain't No Love, you know, I can go check out their older stuff just to see kind of like what they're up to, because, you know, it's always good to be able to go and check out what they were doing and if it led up to what they're doing now. So, yeah, no, that's, you know, a fantastic thing to be able to have that accessible, you know, worldwide, because some people, it's just on a CD somewhere, like, oh, man, you know, I have all that old music somewhere that I used to do. And, you know, some folks, they get to have it on streaming services.
Well, if it's not on streaming, it'll be definitely on YouTube anyway. There was an album, the last album, Sub-Sub, which is actually quite hard to get in physical version of it. It's called The Delta Tapes. Yeah. So that's definitely, if you hear that as a record, you can definitely, it's kind of like the missing link, I guess, between Sub-Sub and Doves, I suppose.
Folks, that's going to do it for this episode of The Talking Drum. We want to close out with a very, very special. We want to close out this episode with another selection of Doves. This is one of my favorite drum tracks of Andy's. I'm going to let it speak for itself. We'll see you on the next episode. Take care. Blue Justice. This is Spellbound by Doves.